being here.
Thank you very much, Mark. Unlike the rather daunting room we had yesterday where I was confined to a podium, I'm free today. And I'm hoping what I might do is to use the floor space and you to do a bit more of an interactive type discussion. So rather than me doing my talk and then having questions at the end, you're more than welcome to ask questions at the end, but what I want to just signal to you is you can interrupt me at any time and ask questions, and we can have a dialogue. We should go off onto what you're interested in and not necessarily what I'm interested in, but I'll try and sort of make those coincide. The idea of today's talk is to go through a discussion of the evolution of telephone competition. And it's sort of worth doing this, I think, for a variety of reasons. One is that the theme of this conference is a marvelous one, and that is the lessons we've learned over the last century of regulation. I was reminded when I thought about that and the slides that I'm going to go through in terms of looking back over time at the evolution of competition in telecommunications, of the comment by George Santayana, who said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." I always think this is the guy that does that song with Nickelback, but I know that's not it. At any rate, what I think we need to do to sort of get a sense of this is to, I think, do three things. One, I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of the industry itself. And secondly, I want to talk about the evolution of the lens of competition. That is to say, how do we view and how have we viewed the notion of competition in this industry? And more generally, and how we brought the evolution of that thinking about competition to telecommunications. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of public policy. And I think most people in this room are really quite familiar with the first of these three topics. And I'll walk through that with apologies to those of you who are really well-versed in this. But I do want to walk through it because I think it's relatively important to just establish the foundation of what has evolved in this industry, and then to think about the other two topics. The first slide I want to talk about is actually this wonderful sort of slide that in many ways brings together this whole notion of a century of lessons learned about the telecommunications industry and the evolution of it. A few years ago, I was invited to the opening of the National Digital Library, the digitalization of our national library, of the Library of Congress, where the Library of Congress decided to take the books that they have and put these in digital format. And it was really great because I was there at the opening. What they decided to do was to, as their first project, digitize the handwritten notes of Alexander Graham Bell. And so let me show you these. This is the original diagram that he drew on the morning of the experiment of the invention of telephone. You can see his diagram there on the left. M is the mouthpiece. I think everybody can read this. It's a little hard, but you can read. On the right-hand side, it'll say receiving instrument and the transmitting instrument. And he describes this, and the passage that we all know is the one that will spill over onto the next page, but it says, "Mr. Watson was stationed in one room with the receiving instrument. He pressed his ear closely against S and closed his other ear with his hand. The transmitting instrument was placed in the other room, and the doors of both rooms were closed." And this is the phrase that everyone knows. "I then shouted," this is an interesting phrase, "I shouted into him the following sentence, 'Mr. Watson, come here, I want to see you.' To my delight, he came and said, declared that he had heard and understood what I had said." Now, that's a marvelous phrase. And what I wanted to point out to you is is not that which you all know. But a little farther down here, there, beginning in this, I guess you can call it paragraph, when they switched, we then changed places. And I listened at Aswell. Mr. Watson read a few passages from a book into the mouthpiece M. It was certainly the case that, now here's the part where I want you to think, start thinking cell phones at this point. It certainly was the case that articulated sounds proceeded from S. The effect was loud but indistinct and muffled. If I had read beforehand the passage given by Mr. Watson, I should have recognized every word. As it was, I could make out a sense, but an occasional word here and there was quite distinct. I made out to and out and further, and finally the sentence, Mr. Bell, do you understand what I say? Do you understand what I say? I live in Verizon's home territory, and they have a very famous commercial that says, can you hear me now? And this is very much in that spirit. So that's where it started. And if we want to put a chronology on the evolution of the industry, is this, I think. That began, again, many of you know this, is a patent monopoly, followed by a period of open competition. And you'll see that in sort of thinking about the evolution, and I'll come to public policy later, but today we take for granted that the industry is really regulated at the state level with public utility commissions, and for interstate telecommunications at the federal level with the FCC. At the time, it was regulated principally in the earliest days by municipal regulation. I want to come back to that because the notion of municipal regulation is going to come back into play, it turns out, today, I think. And so I just simply wanted to point that out, that the first regulation of municipals by municipalities came in 1878. There was a period of open competition, consolidation, growth of regulation. There was a period of regulated monopoly. Some cracks in this monopoly beginning to appear, a divestiture. We had the Telecommunications Act in 1996 with what I think could be called a full total embrace of the notion of competition. And finally, a consolidation wave. And what I'd like to do is maybe step through these in a little bit of detail with the notion of saying, look, here's how the industry looked like at its very inception. It was a period that these are households, HHs, households. And so you had, let's just say, four households on a street, and you had a set of competing local exchange companies, LEC1, LEC3, and as it turned out, AT&T, which was in the local exchange business, but also happened to be in the long distance business. And so the very curious thing for any of you who have, and I suspect all of you have, lived through the debate of the constraint that AT&T faced in the most recent period of the 96 to 2004 period of saying we need to get back into local exchange telephony and that there is a real bottleneck in local exchange. The bottleneck at the outset was not on the local side, but rather on the long distance side. And it was that power right here of intercity transport that AT&T had that allowed it in a variety of senses to be able to begin to take over, if you will, the industry. There were some marvelous studies, one done by Steve Wyman and Richard Levin at Yale, and on predation in this very early period that I would commend to you. And there's a paper by David Gable on this, on how it is that this sort of structure led to a set of competitive challenges in the very early days. Ultimately, we passed a set of, as I mentioned yesterday, Theodore Vail, the president of AT&T, had this notion of one policy, one system, universal service. And I talked yesterday about this movement toward universal service. The other parts of that, of course, were one system. And the company acquiesced to federal regulation under the notion of a natural monopoly. under the notion of a natural monopoly. So the world got very simple at that point. We had households that, and here they weren't called POPs at the time, but a central office with a switch, they would carry traffic inner city. But it was, the point was that there was a single provider. And I'll come back to this under the notion of how we viewed this. The movement from that natural monopoly position, from that single industry, to a bunch of competitors that you might have seen subsequently, was not one of conscious design. And again, we'll come back to this, but what you saw were some inadvertent cracks in the Bell monopoly, beginning with the Hushapon. And I think maybe everybody knows the story. Hushapon was simply a plastic coupling device that people could use to speak quietly, and Hushapon sold these things like hotcakes, and AT&T viewed this as an affront to the integrity of the telecommunications network and said, you, the FCC, need to stop this, and in fact was successful in getting the FCC to block entry by this company that was just a very simple plastic coupling device. It was only through the Court of Appeals that this was overturned. So we got the seeds of competition, not through regulation. And this is one of the things in terms of lessons learned, this history lesson that we learned in part is going to be that you can't necessarily rely on, and you'll see this emerging at several points in all three of these sort of themes that I want to hit today, is that you can't necessarily rely on competition, on regulation, to be the champion necessarily of promoting competition. Here we see that, as an example, MCI began to seek entry into the market in 1963, and in 1969 was able to enter the market. That was sort of 6 years by my count. And I mean, they had a business plan. They wanted to deliver private line service from Chicago to St. Louis and back and forth, and it took them 6 years to get that in that market. The FCC did ultimately open the long-distance market with the ExecuNet decision into long-distance. AT&T didn't really like the idea of competition very much. That's another lesson I think we can learn, is that incumbents, as a general proposition, don't like new entrants very much. They would rather be in the position that they're in as unchallenged incumbents. They engaged in a variety of rather nefarious acts from the position of competition, including just simply shutting off MCI's lines one weekend. You know, all these people had subscribed to households to MCI, and so you pick up the phone, and one weekend your line is just dead. It's just like talking into this. Nothing happens. That's not a good thing. And AT&T had that power at that time to do that. That led to an antitrust trial, Sherman Act trial, that began in 1980. AT&T had the audacity, after 6 months of that trial, to move for dismissal or for summary judgment, and Judge Green, being a rather irascible sort, just completely went off on AT&T and effectively said, you're guilty, the burden of proof has shifted, you're going to have to prove you're innocent, effectively. And that sent AT&T scrambling in a variety of ways, including over the White House, where, thank goodness, they did not get a sympathetic ear. They wanted to try to circumvent a variety of things. But ultimately, the case was settled, as we all know, with modification of final judgment, and there was a divestiture. Now, this is a picture that I try and sort of keep in my head, because when I think the world is getting complicated, I try to just get simple. The notion here is pre-divestiture, we had, represented here by the turquoise, a vertically integrated company, AT&T, that had both the Bell local companies and AT&T long lines. And MCI, in the downstream market, the retail market, long-distance market here, was attempting to compete against the vertically integrated company. Yep.
Sir, what do you mean by long lines exactly?
It happened to be just called AT&T Long Lines. It was the long distance arm of AT&T. So the long distance at this level right here is going to be considered long distance, this being local. And so it just happened to be that that's the name of the company that was called AT&T Long Lines, as opposed to the regional or local exchange operating companies. Now, the idea was here that in this world, there were a variety, there came to be, and again, I'm going to get ahead of myself, there came to be a belief that regulation was incapable of halting the nefarious practices or the ability of AT&T as a vertically integrated provider to keep them from discriminating against downstream long-distance rivals. So the idea was, and in fact what happened was, we moved to a divestiture that separated those, with Bell operating companies operating at local exchange company, AT&T and MCI, Sprint, and as it turns out, lots and lots of other competitors downstream. Now, in this world, the incentives change pretty dramatically because now the Bell operating companies don't have an incentive to discriminate against any of these people. They just have an incentive to pump out as many minutes as they possibly can to sell access. The vision after the divestiture, the notion of, when I say post-Act, this post-Telecommunications Act, the vision of the Act, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, was there are going to be conditions under which the Bell operating company should be able to reintegrate into the long-distance market. The condition that was sort of imposed by the Department of Justice was that this open, that this upstream market was subject to the condition of irreversibly competitive. That it was irreversibly competitive. That once you made this market irreversibly competitive, it's okay for them to integrate in. Right? And so the idea was that you then have in this world of after the 96 Act, a set, you'd be able to see consumers benefiting, not necessarily from vertical separation, but the fact that there would be a bunch of vertically integrated side-by-side competitors. So the long-distance firms, AT&T and Sprint and others, could integrate upstream because the upstream markets were irreversibly open to competition, and the box could integrate downstream. Now, we got sort of, in the wake of the Act, you got a lot of entry, a lot of interest in entry at the local exchange level, and you got a big push by the box to get in to the long-distance market. Now, after the Telecommunications Act, and before we go to the Act, but after the divestiture, it's worth sort of pausing and saying what was, and I didn't quite know where to put this slide, but I just felt compelled to show it, is that people tend to overlook, it's just remarkable how quickly people forget what the effects of this structural separation were on, or what the effects were on consumers. And so it's just worth looking at this. Pre-divestiture, we had little or no consumer choice. AT&T had a 90% market share. There's one nationwide network. There's complete dialing disparity. You'd have to dial, 10 digits to get to MCI. There was no demonstrated ability of competitors to expand. You couldn't really know that that was the case. There was no real propensity or willingness to switch. And a coast-to-coast call in 1983, a coast-to-coast call, five-minute daytime call, cost 55 cents a minute. After divestiture, by 2001, I stopped it there because that was when the Bell operating companies really began to get in. You sort of get a convoluted sort of effect. But there were over 700 long-distance firms that had entered the market. Typically, in just my checking, various exchanges, you say, I live in Salisbury, Maryland. I just did this randomly. You call Salisbury or Great Falls, Montana, or Littleton, Colorado, or Gainesville, Florida, most typically you'd say, okay, how many choices do I have for my long-distance provider? Most typically they would have about 25 to 30 long-distance carriers at that point to choose from. And anybody that, we were talking about telephones and wired telephones, the reason we, in that last session, the reason we may not have wired telephones in the future is because so many people ripped them out because they're so mad at telemarketers, the long-distance companies trying to sell you long-distance service during that period. There were lots of benefits. Very, very much there was the demonstrated willingness of consumers to switch. Tens of millions of households over the period in the 80s and 90s were switching long distance providers every year. So this was truly something where I was getting a good deal from MCI, or I was getting a good deal from Sprint, or Telechoice, or any other long distance provider. And the cost was, in terms of price, was down to 7 cents a minute. Now, to be fair, there were some other things going on. There's a lot of access charge changes going along the way. So not all of this was due to the structural change.
Wait, none of it was due to the structural change. It all could have happened without divestiture. Legislation passed the Senate that would have required equal access. Fiber optics didn't have anything to do with divestiture, but they caused the cost of transmission to plummet. Access charge reform was about half of the change there. It was, I think access charges were about 20 cents a minute in 1980.
You just said two things, Chuck. One is none of it was due to the structural change, and then you said that half of it was due to access reform. I'll agree with you on the latter. I won't agree with you on the former. I think that a structural change and this is something that has been debated in the literature, and we can pull out the papers, but I think there is a role, and a very positive role, that competition played in driving down long distance rates.
But we could have had competition without divestiture. We could have had competition without divestiture. We could have imposed equal access obligations on AT&T. Right. It was understood how to do that. And it wouldn't work.
And this is actually a very healthy thing to this is exactly the tension in the literature that exists. It's a very honest one. Because with the position you're just saying is, look, what we need to do, all we need to do is impose equal access, keep this structure, impose equal access, and we'll have been fine. Now, Assistant Attorney General Baxter and a lot of other good people did not believe that was the case. They thought that regulation was incapable of accomplishing what you suggested it accomplished. There are other people, and I gather you're one, that believe we could have done this. We could have kept this structure imposed through regulation a sufficient number of safeguards and still accomplished all the good things we've accomplished. And I suspect there will always be some amount of debate on that. I will say this. I won't go so far as to say all, and I'll try to be very careful when I just said that all of it was due to the change in industry structure, but I will stand by the statement that part of it was. This is a convoluted, complicated chart, and everybody has heard, if you're in the telecommunications industry, 20 or 30 talks now about the three ways of entry that the Telecommunications Act allowed, either full facility-based entry or resale or unbundled network elements. So I won't go back through that. Simply to say that the notion was, it was a very clever notion, is that even if you had a network that over this network you could allow for entry that would be, in a sense, partly facility-based and partly resale. And entrants would have the choice of buying the various pieces or building the various pieces that they want, and that would be a way of entry. There's a lot of interest in entry. And in fact, there were lots of new entrants in the local exchange industry. Subsequently, there were lots of failures. And again, very much like the discussion Chuck and I just had, there is a debate, a very legitimate debate, about was the demise of these new entrants a function of a shake out of the industry, which we all know, that at least from the economics literature, that firms that enter often fail. And you have lots of firms that did fail. Was it a function of a shakeout, or was it a function of a shakedown? And there are arguments there both ways. I simply point out that lots of firms did fail.
Who who shook down who, that is?
If there was a shakedown going on, it was in the power of the, effectively, the last, and again, I'll make the story too simple, the control of that last mile. And the inability of new entrants to successfully integrate the long distance firms to be able to successfully integrate back into the local exchange through a delay, either a delay, a denial, or a denigration of those local access facilities. So we'd love to help you out, we'd love to give you co-location space, but it's not available for that. Come back tomorrow. That, again, I'm making that too simple, but that's the tension in the debate. Now, where are we today? Where we are today in terms of the industry is that after this big shakeout, we have now had some relatively, indeed, very large mergers between AT&T and SBC, Verizon MCI, and Sprint Nextel. And we have, as Duane Ackerman suggests, a convergence has finally happened. And here, what I want to just point to is something that we're not going to be able to answer today, but it is very much a question, and that is, and the way I just expressed this was convergence, exclamation point, as Mr. Ackerman suggests, or convergence with a question mark. I did not go back and actually find this article, but I do distinctly remember reading an article in 1980, and I'm almost sure it was Business Week, that talked about the convergence of telephony and cable television, and it was 1980. We're now in 2006, and we're still talking about it. I suspect it really is. There are lots of signs that make me now believe that it really is finally happening, but I think it is not necessarily, and this is something that maybe is important for policymakers, is there's not necessarily a given. I think there are things that public policy might do and might to affect this, and I'll come back to that. Now, let me turn to the issue of the evolution of competition. George Stigler, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, has a nice little quote. He says, to determine whether an industry is workably competitive, therefore simply have a good graduate student write his dissertation on the industry and render a verdict. Now, that would be wonderful if that was the only thing that George Stigler said.
But we can do that. Troy Kwas, Troy, on this topic.
Troy,
just tell us.
Troy.
Troy is very... right. Troy, well, thank you, Troy. You played very nicely into this. Unfortunately, Professor Stigler followed his first line with a second that says, it's crucial this test, of course, that no second graduate student be allowed to study the industry. So what I want to do now is, and I hope this will create a little bit of a value add, is to say how, given the evolution of the structure of the industry, how is it that economists, how have economists viewed the notion of competition over time? And I don't want to get too touchy-feely here, but you know, if you go to a therapist, a psychologist will tell you, well, you know, what's your reality? And that's not necessarily someone else's reality. There are different realities, and the realities change over time. And very much like us, even though economists would like to wave off the notion that there is anything subjective about how we view the world, in fact, the way we view the world has evolved over time. And it's worth just simply recognizing that and knowing some of the tools that have evolved over time. And I want to take just a few minutes, and again, my apologies to those of you who are the professors in the room who teach this every day, and my apologies to those of you who also don't care a lick about about academic research, but let me just talk for a minute through this because I think it's worth talking about. The evolution began in the 1920s with the advent of state and federal regulation with a belief that telecommunications was a natural monopoly. A natural monopoly is an industry in which a single firm is the least cost provider of total industry output. So it's completely efficient, completely proper for a single firm to be the monopolist, and you'd engage in public interest regulation. You just regulate in the public interest for that natural monopoly. And that went along just fine for a long time. In 1962, and the technology does play a role, you're right, you're exactly right about that, but even without the role of technology, economists in the 1960s, two papers were really very influential, I think. One was a paper by Average and Johnson, and some of you have read this paper, but it basically said, well, wait a minute here, in sort of not the math, but in words, did institution of rate of return regulation is structurally flawed. Regulation is systematic, rate of return regulation is systematically flawed. If it's done absolutely as well as possibly can be done, it still is going to create inefficiencies in the marketplace. Second article, by George Stigler again and Claire Freeland, asked a question called, what can regulators regulate? And they went back, not in the telecommunications industry, but in the electric utility industry, and said, look, if regulation makes a difference, if regulation really is in the public interest, then you ought to observe a change for the better once the institution of regulation happens. So they went back to the institution of state public utility commissions in the electric utility industry and said, was there any evidence that prices changed for the better for consumers, or that in terms of direction, that is now, or that there was less evidence of price discrimination as a consequence of the institution of regulation? And to the best of their ability, they could not find any positive effect. Didn't necessarily find negative effect, but just didn't find a positive effect. Now, that result is actually very, very damning. The two of them together said, well, regulation's flawed, and we can't find this doing any good. Now,
they were both college students.
These two studies, you know, I said that there were cracks in the Bell monopoly. Those were sort of cracks in the intellectual integrity of the notion of natural monopoly and public interest regulation. And this got another sort of booster shot, if you will, in 1968 with a paper that a guy named Harold Dimsitz wrote called Why Regulate Utilities. In that paper, Dimsitz says, and he doesn't quite say it this way, but he said, effectively says, let's take the strongest possible case for the institution of rate of return regulation, a pure natural monopoly, an industry where a single provider is the most efficient provider. Does rate of return regulation in that instance do anybody any good? And he said, well, no, as a matter of fact, it doesn't, because you don't need to have competition in the market, you can have competition for the market. You can institute a system of franchise bidding and achieve all of the benefits of competition prior to the running of the market. So you have a competitive process on the front end, and you wind up with a single firm providing the product at the end as a franchise monopolist. But guess what? You don't need a state public utility commission. You don't need the FCC. You don't need any of that. Sorry, guys, if you work at the commission. I'm going to save you a little while. I know you're feeling uncomfortable right this minute. But Dimsitz said no. And again, this is a very damning critique. I said, well, wait a minute here. If that's the case, then why don't we just do it that way? Well, there was in all of these cases, and this one in particular, it kicked in. I didn't put it on the slide, a sort of a response to this that began to get economists thinking about regulation as a contract and said, well, wait a minute here. If, in fact, what we're going to do is have a competitive process on the front end, and then the provider is going to contract with, let's say, the regulatory agent, the state, to provide this now looking ex post monopoly service, then we've got to have that contract be enforceable and create benefits. And a guy named Oliver Williamson argued that, in fact, there are a lot of conditions under which if you start to view this as a contract, the notion of bidding ex ante is not going to save you from the need to regulate. We're still going to need to regulate. I told you I'd make you feel better. That you still are going to need this. 1970s, along comes, and Chuck and I mentioned this just a moment ago, the notion of Baxter's Law. Baxter's Law was Assistant Attorney General Baxter, not an academic, that basically said that the regulatory apparatus was incapable of halting the ability of a vertically integrated monopolist to engage in discriminatory tactics. Right? And that really tended to influence the academic community, and it certainly influenced the pursuit of the antitrust case. Now, along comes in the 1970s the emergence of what now is called the Chicago School. It actually started before that, but with respect to regulation, it began with work published by George Stigler and Richard Posner and Sam Kaltzman called The Economic Theory of Regulation. And as I've noted here, and it's worth going back to what a guy named George Priest said, was that this literature, The Economic Theory of Regulation, contributed significantly to the movement toward broad deregulation of industry, and it constitutes the greatest intellectual triumph of U.S. public policy of modern times. That's a very powerful statement. So what is this economic theory of regulation? All it said is that, and not all it said, but a way to simply capture it is to say that what it views regulation as a function of supply, the supply of regulation and the demand for regulation. The consumers, that suppliers, that providers, upstream and downstream, have a demand for regulation. And that if you want to simply understand how it is that regulation will arise, where it will arise, and what form it will take, you need to really understand the notion of these interest groups, the demand for regulation, and the supply, and you need to understand the supply of regulation. Now, I wanted to put this up because one of the really consistent themes of this entire literature, and I'm not doing this complete justice here because we've got time issues, but a theme of the Chicago School is, as was noted by Priest, the consistent theme was attacking regulation and extolling competition. Now I want to come back to that, okay? So just put that in your head, because that's something that was a crowning achievement of the Chicago School, was talking about the merits of competition and having a great deal of skepticism about regulation. Again, I won't do this justice, but the notion of contestability was quite important. The prospect during the late 70s, early 80s was contestability. That is to say, might there be markets that have completely free entry and exit? In which case it doesn't matter that a market winds up being concentrated. Then you wind up, it's not a problem if you have a firm, call it Bell South, call it whoever it is, that might have a really large market share, that you have a lot of concentration in that market, if in fact entry is sufficiently easy and exit is sufficiently easy. And that led to the notion of it works best, but not perfectly, off in areas like airlines, where you can fly the capital around and entry was easier. In telecommunications, the jargon went through, and we thought a lot about it, but in fact, most telecommunications markets involve massive amounts of sunk cost. Now, again, everybody saw the movie with John Nash. I won't bore you with game theory, but we thought a lot. We've begun to think a lot in the economics community about the interaction between competitors. If you have even small numbers of competitors, an oligopoly situation, you can, under various circumstances, either have theoretically conditions that lead to outcomes, market outcomes that look exactly like a purely competitive market. Or, I'm sorry to say, completely the opposite. That is, you can get a complete monopoly situation. So that's not a particularly happy thought for those of us who would like to have the world be very simple. But it really points then to an empirical renaissance in industrial organization economics called the New Empirical Industrial Organization Economics. It was sort of captured by a summary paper by Tim Bresnahan at Stanford. And so we need to look in depth at industries with econometric modern econometric techniques and understand something about those supply elasticities and the behavior of pricing to cost. And that has continued. And in the 1990s, people began to really focus also on saying, look, we need to view competition in lots of markets, but telecommunications winds up being a prime example of where you don't have a single principle, a single firm doing operating by itself, but rather there is a principle called society, and there are agents that we would like to behave in certain ways. So you might like, as an institution, as a society, to ensure that Bell South or Verizon or AT&T or whoever it is behaves in certain ways, and that there are tools in economics within the context of a principal-agent model to construct incentive schemes to try to get, if it were a competitive market, through contracts and through the principal-agent models. And Dave Sapping has been a principal contributor to that literature. There's also, during the 90s, a host of, I think it sort of follows up on Bresnahan's point, a host of work that has been empirical evaluations of what really actually has been the effect of deregulation on prices and telecommunications. What are the factors that have driven competition in this market? What have been the factors that have caused regulation or deregulation to occur in a political economy sense? And this sort of explosion has continued in the since 2000. I point out only one area of new work, but it is an important one, I think, and that is going way back to. Let me flip back through this. This chart to say, look, if I've got this situation that winds up with a vertically integrated firm, and I say, well, might the upstream firm like to favor its own downstream operation? The answer is yes. There are conditions under which it would. And the best way to do it, the first choice to do it is simply to deny access, just to cut them off. But that's pretty visible, we already saw that led to an antitrust suit, so maybe they're not going to do that. Second way you might like to do is say, well, okay, I can't cut them off. Maybe I'll do it with price. I'll engage in price discrimination. But then you can pass a law that says, well, gee, let's have equal access. And then you got to charge everybody downstream the same price. Well, that doesn't change anything about the incentives of the upstream firm, so it just looks for another way to do it. And one way to do it may be through what is referred to now in the literature as sabotage. That is to engage in non-price discriminatory tactics against the downstream rival. And that has become a sort of growing literature. And again, Dave Sappington has been part of that literature that has been blossoming. Okay, now public policy. Public policy has been perhaps every bit as schizophrenic and has changed over time, as have as the industry and has the lens of competition. We had municipal regulation that gave way to rate of return regulation, that gave way to, I'm scratching my head here and I'm seeing Hushabone come in and MCI come in and maybe what's going on here? There's something not working very well. We saw that antitrust got used as a tool in the 70s, and then we get to the 80s. When we get to the 80s, depending on the particular industry, and they start again, remember this convergence is happening. In the 80s, you saw various forms of regulatory reform that says, okay, if rate of return regulation is flawed, let's begin to move toward a more efficient form of regulation, price caps. And again, I'm sorry, I promise I'm going to quit referring to you, but there's a marvelous survey article that David did on the effectiveness of price cap regulation and the consequences of that. So we engaged in reform of regulation. We also took different approaches to the deregulation process. So deregulation that occurred actually occurred in very different ways, and it has very different implications depending on what you do. In the cable industry, we deregulated the cable industry by removing price regulation authority for the municipalities, but kept their ability to restrict entry. This is great for all of us who teach principles of economics courses, because you sort of say, okay, where's an example of when you can watch a control experiment about what happens when you've got a pure monopoly with complete pricing latitude? All right, here's a firm that has been told you have no price caps, but no pricing limits, but we're going to keep barriers to entry total. We're going to keep governmental barriers to entry in place, and you have pricing flexibility. So what happened was cable prices went up at 3 or 4 times the rate of inflation during that period. Over on the other side, in the long-distance market, there was a demonstration of the presence of effective competition. Barriers to entry had been completely eliminated. Virtually anybody could enter that industry as a reseller, and many, many people did. And there you had a very different outcome, as I suggested, that prices really fell. In 1996, we came to the, if you look at the Telecommunications Act now, the sort of moribund Telecommunications Act, it really did embrace for the first time totally the notion of competition in communications markets. But in the wake of that,
why was cable deregulated? Why was that viewed as fun? You've got coax cables, mm-hmm. looks pretty natural, monopolistic.
That's a very good question. And it actually, if we had been smart about it, we would have been able to see that it actually has to do with the point that I didn't see coming. I don't think a lot of people saw coming in telecommunications, but it happened in cable back in the 80s, is that there was a concern that said, if you don't deregulate, we won't invest. If we get deregulated and allow the prices to go up, then you're going to see a lot of channels come online. You're going to see the willingness to invest. And in hindsight, again, there's a lot of work done on this, but it's very difficult to parse out what happened. We do know that prices went up. They went up dramatically. But it also turns out they used part of those funds to invest in their network.
And so did inflation on everything else, including Medicare.
Yeah.
So was it through true competition, or was it just through inflation?
Well, there's evidence to suggest that there was an exercise of monopoly power. There are a number of papers that suggest that this was a period of the exercise of monopoly power that they had. But they probably used part of the monopoly profits to plow back and invest in a better network. So did consumers in part benefit from the expansion of channels? Yes. Were they also hosed as a result of higher prices? Yes. So, and this investment debate comes back up, and I didn't see it coming. I don't know if other people did. In the wake of the Telecommunications Act, that the incumbent provider said, listen, if you will make us share our network, we're not going to have any incentive to invest. And the industry is not going to be able to provide the highest quality service. We'll just simply disinvest in this industry, and nobody wants that. And that argument really took hold. And ultimately, I think, was quite persuasive to a number of people at the FCC and in the administration and in the courts. So in 2004, essentially, through a variety of things, the administration really pulled the plug on that approach, of the unbundling approach. So what that led to, of course, was AT&T and MCI had been saying for years that if the administration could not guarantee that they had access to unbundled network elements, that they were going to go under. And I don't know that anybody really believed it. Now we can believe it. They did. So we've got a situation where AT&T and SBC merged, Verizon and MCI merged. Now, so what we're doing now is betting the bank, if you will, on
the notion of intermodal competition. The idea is here, okay, we're going to have competition through cable and wireless and wireline, and in this grand world, not everybody has to be the wireline provider, but you can have competition in intermodal world. And I put this phrase, you may not appreciate that, but I have this, somebody asked me the other day, I said, how's this going to work out? And every time I think about how this is going to work out, I think of an Indiana Jones movie. I think of, you know, the scene where the giant ball is rolling down and Indy's running like crazy. Think of Indy as the metaphor for competition. And Indy is either going to get completely flattened in this process, or he's going to be able to jump out of the way, pull out his whip, and rescue the woman, and we're going to all be happy. But that's where we are, and I don't know that people are certain about this outcome. So, we had a lot of optimism in 1996. Susan Ness said, opportunities abound for both industry and consumers.
Can I go back to the previous slide? I think you mentioned, you said that the loss of access to unis was associated with the merger and sort of disappearance of MCI and AT&T. But I heard Dave Dorman of AT&T, he was the chairman, I guess, at the time, talk about it. And basically, I think he said it was the criminal activities of the leadership of what was then called WorldCom that destroyed the economics of AT&T, forced them to sell off their wireless and their cable, ruined their strategy, and ultimately destroyed both companies. And that it wasn't the FCC, it was Bernie Ebers.
I've listened to Dave Dorman do that talk too, and what you described is in fact part of the story. I think it's a completely legitimate part of the story. You had AT&T operating under tremendous pressure when it looked at the benchmark competitor of MCI or WorldCom at the time. And I think he is exactly right. It's a very credible story, and you listen to the people at AT&T that said that put a lot of pressure on them, and it did destroy a lot of value for AT&T. And it did perhaps accelerate their looking a bit like a deer in the headlights. And so are we going to jump to $100 billion of investment in cable? Are we going to push the resale? What are we going to do? But if you listen to that talk, I think Mr. Dorman also will tell you very clearly, and they pushed very, very hard on this thing, we need the ability to get in on an unbundled network element platform. And absent that, we don't have, every other door is shut for us, effectively. And so it wasn't necessarily, I think, an either or, but both factors probably played a role. There was a lot of optimism in 96. This was sort of fun to look back at. I just pulled some quotes Rachel Chong said it's going to catapult the country right in the information age. And Howard Baker, a great man, said, I can now confidently predict that Telecommunications Act 96 will usher in an era of communications innovation that will shortly make our present arrangements as antiquated as the Gutenberg press. So there's a massive amount of enthusiasm. And today, we wind up with, you know, there was a lot of disappointment, I think, when these mergers happened. We thought, well, this is, we're going to have to pick up ourselves off the floor here. And in fact, if you look forward now, though, once we've digested the pill, and for some of us it was a rather big pill, that long-distance competitors really aren't going to be able to, or other firms enter as standalone local exchange companies, there is a way to go. And by the way, here, I love this quote on public policy by Mike Shearer. Said, the supreme power who conceived gravity, supply and demand in the double helix must have been absorbed elsewhere when public utility regulation was invented. I had to put that one in when I thought of this discussion of public policy. How are we on time?
About 10 more minutes.
10 more minutes. Remember, 15 minutes ago, I said that the Chicago School approach was very critical, not in a mean-spirited way, but in a scrutiny way, very critical of regulation and whether it really accomplished the goals that it seeks to accomplish. And extolled the virtues of competition. Now, I want to bring something to your attention in terms of the public policy evolution here of a Supreme Court case that some of you, but probably not all of you, know about called the Trinco case. The Trinco case was a case brought all the way to the Supreme Court against Verizon under an antitrust a Sherman Act monopolization case brought against Verizon for discriminatory provisioning of OSSs, the operational support systems, an unbundled network element, and whether that constituted a separate antitrust offense that would be actionable. Ultimately, the Supreme Court took this case on and observed that regulation, of course, and this is well established in the antitrust literature, can in fact create an immunity from antitrust. That is to say that regulated firms doing what regulators or in particular states tell them to do are in many instances made exempt from antitrust. They can't both do what one master tells them to do, the state, and then get stabbed in the back by create an antitrust liability. But in the Telecommunications Act, there was something called the Savings Clause. And the Savings Clause is this quote right here. It's in the Telecommunications Act. It says the following. It says, nothing in this act or the amendments made by this act shall be construed to modify, impair, or supersede the applicability of the antitrust laws. That would seem to say that the firms that Verizon would be made liable, not necessarily guilty, but be subject to antitrust scrutiny. The Supreme Court ruled, and I won't go into the details of this too much. I've got a paper on this if any of you are interested. The Supreme Court ruled that no, it was not, Verizon was not subject to antitrust liability. And it was grounds, oddly enough, that I thought that the claim would modify existing law, and I won't go into the rationale for that, but that it would move beyond our current existing application of antitrust law to do so. But what I did want to highlight here is that the court found comfort in the existence of regulation, said no, Verizon's not guilty, is not subject to, we don't need to worry about Verizon's behavior on grounds of anti-competitive activity because we've got regulation in place. The existence of regulation should give us comfort. Oh, and by the way, if antitrust were used, the antitrust could go off and do a bunch of bad things. And we could apply antitrust in a very poor fashion and create damages. Now, what I want to point out to you is this is effectively, I think, turned the Chicago School absolutely on its head. George Stigler must be up there whirling in his grave at this moment. Because what we have now done is suggested that regulation is and should be our comforting blanket in assuring the absence of anti-competitive behavior, and that we really shouldn't rely on antitrust because it is an ineffective tool. And I think this creates, at this particular moment, a lot of tension in the evolution of these two public policies, of regulation and deregulation and antitrust policy. And it'll be interesting to see how that's going to play out over time. Critical issues to watch, I think, as the industry moves forward. I told you I'd come back to this. The notion of municipal franchise. Right now, I have those pictures of talking about industry convergence of cable over here and wireless and local and long distance. And right now, the grand irony, the absolute grand irony is that after having swallowed the long distance companies who were the new entrants and the ILEX were the incumbents, the RBOX, the SBC and Verizon have now integrated in the long distance firms that were the new entrants. The grand irony is that now we find the telcos in the position of the new entrant. They want desperately to get into the video industry. And the cable companies can get into telcos into the telephone business through cable modem and a VoIP phone. But for the telcos to get into the cable industry, guess what they've got to do? They've got to go fight an incumbent in 33,000 local franchises. There are 33,000 local franchising agents in the United States, and guess what? The cable companies are fighting them in every single one. So we have this sort of ironic position of the telephone companies now being the new entrants. And absent that reform, absent some streamlining, I very much fear that you're going to see a complete dragging out of this process of video entry into the video markets by the telcos, and that effectively keeps us as a balkanized platform of the broader communications industry with cable over here and telcos over here. Of course, there's the issue of intercarrier compensation that stands in the way, I think, of the emergence of some elements of competition. We've got vertical issues and small number of competition that we need to think about. And it is going to be absolutely fascinating to observe the strategies of the firms that are in place right now. We've got a fascinating merger, $37 billion merger between Sprint and Nextel, where the company has now said, what we're going to do is spin off our local, we've got so many wireless customers, we're going to spin off our local exchange operations. The fact of that separation will create a completely different set of incentives on the part of Sprint Nextel than it has prior to the spin. I just keep waiting. There's the famous pin drop commercial. What we're going to see, I keep waiting for a picture with a telephone and some lopping shears to cut the cord, because Sprint Nextel will have only an incentive to go after wireline customers. I mean, they'll go after other wireless business, but the low-hanging fruit may very well be all of us who still have that wired phone. And they're the only company among the big telcos that do not have any mixed incentives. Verizon has a cellular business. Singular is engaged with the telcos, but Sprint Nextel does not. And we'll see how vigorously they pursue that. Obviously, these guys, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South, are going to, how quickly they move to broaden it to engage in competition in the video area is going to be interesting. And will they actually be able to help themselves? Will AT&T and Verizon and Bell South be content in their home markets? And I think you actually get a little bit of a mess up here. I think that the egg is starting to scramble. When SBC bought AT&T, they didn't buy just a long-distance company operating in the Southwestern, in the SBC territory. They bought a company with customers in New York City. And that's going to potentially scramble the egg and create out-of-region competition. Last comment. There was a famous basketball player, we talked about basketball yesterday, but there was a famous basketball player named Jason Kidd who, when he came out of school, was drafted number one by the Dallas Mavericks, and because he's just an outstanding basketball player. And, you know, when you go through college and you're number one draft pick, it's a heady time for somebody. And they asked Jason at his first press conference, said, what difference are you going to make to this organization? Dallas was a terrible team, of course, at the time. That's how he got the number one pick. And what Jason said was this. He said, now that I'm here, we'll turn this program around 360 degrees. I had to think about this one because I think perhaps after me talking now for over an hour, we've just gone around the loop 360 degrees, so I may not have changed anybody's mind, but I hope we've sort of a more educated circle, so I may have turned you around 360 degrees. Thank you very much.